The Guardian.
Support for this podcast comes from Squarespace, the all-in-one platform that makes creating a professional website for your business, personal brand, or portfolio so easy, it's newsworthy. Go to squarespace.com and use the offer Guardian to get 10% off.
Hello, and welcome back to Science Weekly with me, Ian Sample. Coming up on the show, have we been approaching climate change in completely the wrong way? This year's Sense About Science lecture considers a dramatically different approach to our biggest challenge as a species. We'll speak to this year's lecturer, Professor Steve Rayner. Also on the show, we'll have our picks from the week's science news, including the US and China reach a landmark climate deal, Jean-Claude Juncker axes the role of European Chief Science Advisor, and the outlook for the Philae lander on Comet 67P. This is Science Weekly from The Guardian. In the studio, we have Professor Steve Rayner of Oxford University, who's just given this year's Sense About Science lecture, and Adam Vaughan, editor of The Guardian's Environment site. Welcome to you both.
Hello.
Hello.
Steve, tell us about the subject of your lecture this year.
Well, the title of the lecture is Science, Technology and Democracy, Dissecting the Anatomies of Controversy. And I'm in that lecture trying to address some large questions about the relationship between values and science and the kinds of disputes in which science is invoked as an argument to try to express people's political and ethical principles and preferences. And I will be using as a major example in that the issue of climate change and the debates over climate change.
You draw on some of the ideas in the Hartwell paper published in 2010, and this was a paper that came out of discussions that Oxford and LSE experts had at the Hartwell House in Buckinghamshire, I think that is. That paper was suggesting that it's not possible to have a climate policy with emissions reductions as the all-encompassing goal. Why not?
Well, it's not that we're opposed to the idea of achieving emissions reductions. Far from it. We think that that's a very strong imperative. But in that paper, we actually employ an analogy with a saying by the famous landscape gardener Capability Brown, which is confront the object and draw nigh obliquely, which is the best way to achieve emissions reductions might not be to focus directly on emissions reductions. So I think that part of the problem is that the whole issue of climate change was initially conceptualized in the Framework Convention and the Kyoto architecture, essentially as an old-fashioned 1960s end-of-the-pipe pollution problem. Now we would construct national pipes, and the problem is to stop what comes out of the end of the pipe. And I think that that was an unfortunate framing. It was based on three analogies, essentially. One of those analogies was the stratospheric ozone regime, where we derive this architecture of a Framework Convention and protocols. But what we didn't learn from the ozone regime, which we should have done, was that, in fact, the ozone regime does not address emissions. It doesn't talk about emissions. It addresses the production of CFCs. In other words, it looks at the production technology. Two other analogies that were involved there, I think. One was the US sulfur trading program, which had been very successful at reducing sulfur emissions from electric utilities in the United States, and the idea that we would have carbon trading and use that as the mechanism to reduce the carbon emissions coming from the end of the pipe. And I think that that was a very tempting analogy, but also misplaced, because there you're dealing with a very small number of traders, electric utility companies, within the boundaries of a single legal regime to enforce contracts. And obviously, when you're talking about carbon on a global scale, and then you start to throw in the other greenhouse gases into the basket, really the whole idea, I think, becomes much less plausible. And the third analogy was these strategic weapons reduction treaties that were achieved in the 1980s. From that was derived this idea of mutually verifiable stage reductions. And that has proven to be problematic because, as we know, China has been particularly uncomfortable with the idea that other countries should be violating its sovereignty and, as they see it, and monitoring their activities. And they feel that that's inappropriate. So I think those three analogies were very tempting, but ultimately misguided. And I think we would have been doing much better had we, from the very beginning, framed the mitigation aspect of climate change, not the adaptation aspect, but the mitigation aspect, as a technology transformation problem, as an energy modernization challenge. And I think in that way, it would have had much wider appeal. It wouldn't have been subject to some of these disputes that we've been having about the science, which I would argue are really surrogate disputes for talking about the values and the political framework and people's concerns about markets versus regulation and so forth.
What is the fundamental problem, though, of focusing on emissions in this case, of saying we want to bring emissions down? Is it that it doesn't tell anyone how to get there, and so it just leaves a lot of uncertainty and lack of coherence in strategy? Why is it a problem looking at that sort of end of tailpipe kind of idea as you were talking about?
Well, I mean, I think part of it has been the nature of targets, because the targets that we have set for ourselves have been emissions reduction targets. And then we've gotten into all sorts of wrangles about how do we calculate those, particularly if we're using a basket of greenhouse gases, what are the equivalences for CO2, what's a real reduction, and so on and so forth. Whereas I think actually focusing on technology innovation, technology targets, would have been a much more fruitful way to go. They're very concrete. You can actually, you know, count the number of units of a particular generation technology you have on the ground.
As you put it, you know, the initial efforts on climate change began in, you know, the end of the 80s and start of the 90s. Given we're in a much more neoliberal sort of society now, I mean, how does that square with your sort of focus saying let's have technology targets when every government says let's leave it to the market? How does that work?
Well, I think one of the aspects that's appealing about the idea of energy modernization as a goal is that it actually can appeal to different political sensibilities. I think it can appeal to people whose primary focus is on the market and on the private sector as providing an opportunity for innovation, for new product development, and for the market to do what it does really well, which is produce goods and services under fairly well-known conditions, widely understood conditions. I think it also appeals to people whose concerns with climate are very much more focused perhaps on issues of international development, of equality, of access and so on, because one of the things that we outline in the Hartwell paper is the problem that we have 1.5 billion people on the planet without access to safe, reliable electrical energy. That's really an assault to human dignity in the 21st century. So I think, you know, having a programme that actually addresses that need is appeals to that constituency. And then the sort of the more government-orientated constituencies, I think, of course, are always concerned about energy security, particularly with developments that we are currently experiencing with issues to do with Russia and the Ukraine at the present moment in Europe. That surely has to be a high priority. And again, I think the agenda of energy modernisation addresses that. So I think it's a way forward which appeals to a diversity of political agendas, whereas simply emissions reduction is a discourse of constraint. It's a discourse of frugality. And I think it doesn't have such a wide appeal.
So you're saying the current strategy risks just appealing to governments of the left and not to the right? So it's
to constituencies of the left rather than...
Steve, do you think that would have been politically less contentious? Would have been a smoother ride, if you like? Maybe things would have got done a bit quicker if the focus hadn't been on just this general capping idea?
Yes, I do. And in fact, you know, I'm one of a group of people who have been advocating an alternative approach really since the mid-1990s, at which time we suggested that the one big treaty approach wasn't going to work. We suggested from then forward that building a climate response from the bottom up through smaller bilateral and then bigger multilateral forms of cooperation among countries was more likely to lead to a successful outcome more rapidly than the idea of having one big treaty where everybody has to agree everything before anything gets done. I think actually I'm reasonably optimistic at the moment because I'm seeing an increased interest and focus on technology in the climate discourses. And I think the recent agreement between the US and China is at least a step in the direction of the development of those bilateral and multilateral kinds of agreements, which I think are appropriate for emissions reduction. I think adaptation is a different matter. And of course, if we actually want to save lives and property in the next few decades of this century, adaptation has to be a much greater priority than it's been. Adaptation has always been the poor cousin of emissions mitigation, in part because of fears in the 1990s that even talking about it would present a moral hazard, in that it would encourage people to think it was okay to carry on emitting and people would try less hard at mitigation. And also, the formal international arrangements treat the costs of adaptation basically as the cost of failed mitigation. So it's always been a poor cousin rather than a priority. And I think if we are really serious about climate change, particularly given the present trajectory of emissions increasing at about between 3 and 3.5% per annum, we're going to be facing a big adaptation challenge in the not very distant future. And it's time to start on that is now.
Do you not fear that some of those fears over adaptation were sort of quite well founded, in the respect that certainly in the States at the moment the political discourse is very much like, well, we're in for 3, maybe 4 degrees of warming, we can adapt to it ourselves because we're rich and well off, sort of the rest of the world. Is it not a risk that actually that's starting to come to pass a little bit? The kind of, well, mitigation has not worked and isn't going to work, so now it's just, let's focus on adaptation. So we've missed that boat.
Clearly it's realistic to be focused on adaptation. And I would say, particularly, I would argue the main focus should be on adaptation to climate variability, because in adapting to climate variability, you're dealing with issues that are real now, real flooding, real drought, so on and so forth, but which will only get worse as climate change progresses. So as you increase your capacity to deal with climate variability, so you increase your societal capacity to adapt to climate change. And I think that's important because it's inevitable. I don't see any evidence, actually, since adaptation has begun to be discussed more openly, that it has had any negative effect on efforts to secure emissions mitigation.
Do you think any governments are taking adaptation seriously enough? I mean, the UK talks a good talk on it, but then, you know, we've had seen flood defence cuts and then emergency top-ups when, you know, there's lots of pictures of flooded homes for weeks.
I think it's spotty around the world. There's some excellent work has been done by the UK Climate Impacts Programme, and there's some fantastic work going on in the state of South Australia at the present moment. There is beginning to be a shift in the direction of taking adaptation seriously and treating it in the kind of way that I've suggested.
I wanted to go back to what might have gone wrong in the early days. And you suggest that we kind of took the wrong tack in framing this as an environmental problem capable of being solved. And I wondered if you could elaborate on that. What do you really mean by that?
Well, I think climate change is one of a class of what are known as wicked problems. It's a term which was coined by a couple of American planning professors back in the late 1960s, early 1970s. But basically, they're problems which are not susceptible to any kind of definitive solution. They tend to be ongoing challenges with which we can deal more or less well, or respond to more or less well, but not things that, at least in the near future, you expect to fix in any kind of definitive kind of way. And I think climate change is very much like that. It's really a condition under which we have to carry out our lives on the planet rather than a discrete problem that can be solved. There are many other issues like that. You might say, you know, crime, poverty. These are things which tend to be persistent.
But with climate change, you do have a fairly reasonable handle on what's causing your problem. And so why does it qualify for this wicked status, which could be used as a sort of way of saying we can't try and solve it because it's an unsolvable problem?
Well, I look at it differently from that. I say that we recognise it's a different kind of challenge. It's a challenge of, can we manage these conditions better than the way we are managing them at present? And I certainly am optimistic that there's room to do that.
But why unsolvable? Why does it fit into that problem where the hope of doing that is almost put to one side?
As I say, one just has to look at the development gap between the advanced nations and those countries that are much further back in terms of developing their economies and the standard of livings of their people. There's something called the Kaya identity, which is a rather complicated economic formula produced by the Japanese economist Kaya. I'm just an anthropologist, so I find the formal notation quite scary. I've reduced it to basically it's emissions are a function of population, wealth and technology. So you've got three levers potentially you could pull: population, wealth and technology. Well, population isn't actually very attractive as a lever to pull, because if you want to affect emissions this century, you'd actually have to kill people. And the people you'd have to kill are us, the Americans, Brits, Australians. I don't think that's going to be a winner in any democratic political system. And that's because simply the inertia in terms of the population size and so on, you're not going to be able to achieve it through birth control and family planning. The second lever is wealth, and basically what you'd be asking to have happen there is either for people in India and China and Africa to constrain their growth, their economic growth, and not to develop in the way that we've developed and enjoy the kinds of standards of living that we do. I think that would be grossly hypocritical and unacceptable. And the other thing you'd be doing would be asking places like the countries like the United States basically to reduce their standard of living. And I think George Bush put it very clearly when he said the American way of life is not up for grabs. And I don't think that's a viable approach either. So if you take those two levers off the table, what are you left with? You're left with technology. And I think that when it comes to technology, as I say, innovation in the energy sector, particularly the priority I would identify there is the need for storage of electrical energy produced by intermittent renewables. If we could really crack that problem, then I think that would be a potential game changer. But in the meantime, I think, you know, we're looking at a situation where we are wrestling with the fact that even as the industrialized countries seek to reduce their emissions, you're going to see increased carbon emissions from the developing world. I was a couple of years ago reviewing the Australian national flagship program on energy, and we were sitting in a conference room in Newcastle, New South Wales, hearing some very good talks from researchers about ways in which they were helping people to reduce their domestic energy use in Australia. And meanwhile, looking out the window, you could see the conveyors of the coal, the port loading up the coal-carrying ships that were going to export that coal to China. And that's the problem, which is that basically this is another aspect of the challenge, I think, which is there's always an assumption that you put clean energy in the top of the system and it displaces dirty energy at the bottom. That's not actually been the case. We still use as much of every single energy source, or more of every single energy source humanity has ever used, except one, and that was sperm whale oil. And we didn't give that up because we were running out of sperm whales. So, I mean, I think that's the nature of the problem, which is that we've got to get the intermittency of renewables dealt with, and we also still have to bring the price down significantly so that they can compete with fossil fuels. When the price does come down, you see the displacement actually can happen quite quickly, as we've seen in the US with shale gas. The shale gas revolution presents environmentalists with a rather bitter pill to swallow, which is, you know, if we're serious about climate change, we should note that the United States has actually achieved significant emissions reductions over the past few years.
Although we come back to your
because point. Of shale gas.
We come back to your point a second ago.
But the coal's really,
it's not. It means they domestically can wave their flag, but I mean, internationally, as you quite rightly point out, it just means there's more coal, more fossil fuels altogether. It's a bit like David Mackay, the outgoing chief scientist at DEC, who says, you know, if the UK goes down the similar road with shale gas, the only way it's going to cut emissions if there's some is this, you know, magical global deal on climate change. Because of exactly the point you make, that we have, you know, in some of these commodities we have a global market, shale gas doesn't fix climate change.
It doesn't, and neither does energy efficiency, for the obvious reasons that in both cases you're displacing the dirty technology. So I think we've got to think much more carefully about how do you get dirty technologies out of the bottom of the system. And that means, I think, helping the developing countries to develop their energy capacity without locking in to particularly coal-fired electrical power.
Isn't that a key thing, though, that when you talk about these low-carbon technologies becoming cheap enough to displace others, they have to be cheap enough in those developing countries as well, where they have to develop, and if coal is what they've got, coal is what they'll use, and it's hypocritical of us to try and deny that. And so does that make this challenge just all the more harder, presumably?
It does make it hard. I mean, I think we're also facing a situation where we now have more than half the world's population living in urban areas. We're seeing very rapid, dense urbanisation occurring across Asia. And the sort of solution that has been proposed, for example, in the US for dealing with the problem, which is that people would have rooftop solar with their own batteries. And this is actually how you would store electricity in the system. It may work for large, sprawling suburban areas of the US, but it's not going to work for densely populous cities in Asia. So we are still going to need grid electricity. The notion of decentralized, self-sufficient generation with batteries isn't going to work in that instance. And that's why I think that finding a better way to store energy in the grid than the ones we currently have, which are things like pumped storage, where we pump water uphill at night and then let it out in the daytime in order to provide electrical power in the daytime. Those are not very satisfactory solutions, and we can do better.
Do you have a view on where, though, you talk a lot about sort of technology targets, do you have a view on what the share is? You know, is it half renewables? Is it half nuclear? You know, how do you see it breaking down?
I'm not going to get drawn into trying to fix or suggest actual numerical targets. I very firmly believe that the challenge with climate change is to get traction in the right direction rather than worry about setting a particular endpoint. And I think that's the endpoints that are set in terms of the targets are pragmatic questions for governments, for international negotiations, and for city managers, for people in regional government as well, because they may be very different in different places depending on the circumstances that people find themselves.
Given you talk a lot about, you know, if things have been different and so on and so forth, given where we are and emissions targets are the main game in town at a national and an international level, how do you adjust those or do something, tweak those to apply what you're talking about? Because it feels a little bit historical kind of otherwise.
Well, if we lived in an ideal world, I would say everybody would realise that the emissions target approach was a mistake and they would put it aside and they would start again and do everything right. Of course, though, there's been tremendous political and personal capital invested in the Kyoto-style architecture and in the current top-down negotiated settlement architecture. So I don't think you can realistically expect people to simply throw that out instantaneously. It's rather my cause for optimism is the idea that things will emerge from the bottom up and we will see a technology innovation program that will start to do or series of programs that will start to do the heavy lifting on climate change whilst probably leaving this ongoing negotiation stream in place until basically I think it will either converge with the bottom up in some kind of constructive way or will be eclipsed by it because people will say we are dealing with the situation better than in this way. Mm. I think that's a politically realistic way of looking at it.
I think I'd agree with your analysis about two decades worth of political capital being. Yeah.
The festive season is fast approaching, so this year, while you're busy buying gifts for friends and family, why not treat yourself too? This Guardian podcast is supported by Squarespace, the simple yet powerful all-in-one website building platform. With Squarespace, you can easily create your own website for your small business, online store, professional portfolio, or blog. It's simple, and it'll be the one gift you know you won't want to return. Go to squarespace.com and use the offer code Guardian to get 10% off.
Take us through some of the solutions that you cover in your lecture, some of the things you'd like to be seen done to try and move in the right direction.
Again, I'm not a technologist myself, so I'm not really the right person to talk about technical priorities, but I do think that bringing down the costs of solar and wind still further, we've seen tremendous improvements in the past decade, largely through innovation, for example, in China, which has been incremental improvement, gradually bringing down the costs. I think smart devices, smart grids and so on, that's another important priority, and that's an area actually where India can make a major contribution given its IT industry. So I think, you know, the other attractive thing about this idea of focusing on energy modernization is it really provides positive incentives for places like China and India to get involved, whereas the idea of emissions restriction doesn't really provide the same kind of incentives. And then thirdly, I would argue the idea of trying to crack the problem of integrated grid storage. Those are the things I would do on the mitigation side. As I say, then on the adaptation side, I would like to move away from this idea of adaptation as a cost of failed mitigation and see it rather as an imperative to deal with climate variability. The idea that the climate treaty is there to prevent dangerous climate change, climate's always been dangerous and it continues to be dangerous. And we should be dealing much better than we have dealt in the industrialised world, say in New Orleans, with climate variability, and certainly much better than the means available in much of the developing world. Some of that can be quite inexpensive, actually. It's interesting to note that if you think back to Hurricane Andrew in the 1990s, that killed about 70 people but was so expensive that several major insurers wanted to pull out of Florida. In Bangladesh the same year, there was a cyclone or a series of cyclones that killed officially 250,000 people, probably doubled that number. More recently, there's been similar cyclones in Bangladesh, and the death toll has been absolutely slashed to a few hundred through the development of early warning systems and of refuges to evacuate people to and so on. So even relatively low, you know, these are relatively low-cost things that you can do in the developing world to save lives. Saving property in the developed world is a little more expensive because we do insist on putting expensive infrastructure in silly places, like building skyscrapers on the barrier islands at Miami Beach. And then thirdly, I think we have to explore the possibilities of actively intervening in the atmospheric and climate systems to prevent or counteract the consequences of or impacts of climate change. This is a very controversial area, and rightly so. It should be controversial. I think it's something that needs widespread public debate. But the idea that we might, for example, put sulfate aerosols into the stratosphere to reflect some sunlight away from the Earth to cool it, or we might actually invest in an industry that's designed to remove carbon dioxide from the atmosphere and sequester it, for example, as mineralized carbonates or in spent oil and gas wells.
Setting aside all the sort of social and ethical considerations around geoengineering, which is, I think, what you're talking about, do you see any technologies that are coming along in that space that avoid the problem that you're basically locking yourself into a new problem for the next few centuries? You know, if you start pumping sulfates into the atmosphere, that's great, but you're going to then need to do that for decades, or we just go back to sudden rapid warming. I mean, you know, what do you see anything that gets around that that's coming down the track?
Well, I think there's a bit of a dilemma here, which is that the sulfate aerosol injection to the stratosphere has the potential to work very quickly. We know from events like Mount Pinatubo that sulfate aerosols actually can cause prolonged cooling of the Earth. So it's what we might call a high leverage, high impact, quick acting technology. In terms of the actual program costs, not terribly expensive. You know, you could do it for a few billion a year. The problems are that it might actually have unanticipated consequences that we wouldn't want to see, such as disruption of rainfall patterns.
I was going to say, there's been some quite worrying papers out on that.
Yeah, although actually, as I understand it, the results of modelling suggests that we understand the temperature changes quite well. It's the precipitation that we have less confidence in. It's also politically, I think, likely to be quite contentious. If you imagine, for example, that India had done even some experimental sulfate injection immediately prior to the Pakistani floods a couple of years ago, I don't think you would persuade any Pakistani citizen or politician that India was not in some way culpable for those events. So it's a dangerous game to get into, and one that needs to be thought about very carefully. I do think we need to think about it. There are those people, including one of my fellow Hartwell authors, Mike Hulme, friend I respect very greatly, but he feels that we shouldn't even do research into the area.
I think that's risky in another way, making it taboo and something you can't talk about, right?
Right. You know, I think we need to, as I say, we need to do the research. But on the other hand, though, you've got the idea of carbon dioxide removal machines, which people feel much more comfortable about because it looks very much like mitigation. Basically, it's stopping carbon from actually concentrating the atmosphere. It's less of a band-aid. It's more addressing the core problem. On the other hand, to develop an industry worldwide on a scale that can really make a difference to temperatures would take several decades, massive investment.
It seems particularly and then peculiar as well. We've got a load of centralised points where this stuff's coming out of power plants, and we're talking about, you know, trees by motorways that scrub it out.
That's a slightly different issue. I'll come back to that in a second. The problem is, as I say, you take you several decades to build up an industry on a scale that potentially can make a difference. Then you have to wait several more decades, as you do with any emissions reductions, before that makes a difference to the climate system. Now, there is the argument, which you have raised, which is the idea that we should be focusing on taking carbon dioxide out of the waste stream of power stations rather than taking it out of the atmosphere. The advantage in taking it out of the waste stream is, of course, you've got a more concentrated waste stream. The disadvantage is you're likely to have to transport it considerable distances and high-pressure pipelines to reservoirs in order to store it, whereas you could, in theory, build carbon dioxide removal technology in desert areas far from population centres and where you can sequester the carbon on site and you wouldn't have the transportation issues. So there are trade-offs there that can be investigated.
But I think you were saying earlier, Steve, that the idea of these systems that can take atmospheric carbon dioxide, that can strip carbon dioxide out of the atmosphere, would need to be quite vast to actually have any real impact on concentrations of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere.
That's certainly the case. It would be a major industrial commitment. You would be basically reverse engineering 200 years of the fossil fuel industry. You would have to build something on the scale of the current fossil fuel and probably cement and aggregates industry in order to be able to do that.
Which would have enormous emissions associated with it, presumably.
Not necessarily. I don't think the actual development of the infrastructure would necessarily be so emissions intensive as to make this an unthinkable proposition. The question is whether, in fact, in terms of opportunity cost to society, whether building such an industry is something worthwhile relative to where else we could put that investment if we weren't actually pursuing that line.
On the solution side, politically, where do you stand on the idea that democracies are actually not a useful system for tackling this problem just because they're short-term by nature versus the sort of command and control approach of somewhere like China? I mean, I wonder if you look at the UK, you know, you look at how climate change has dropped off the agenda of the economic concerns. I mean, is it just a case that democracies are ill-suited to tackling a long-term global problem like this?
Well, you know, I'm an anthropologist, and so I tend to look to other cultures and also to history. And I think it is the case, historically, that it is hierarchical societies that have built for the long term. Hunter-gatherers never built pyramids, large-scale irrigation systems, cathedrals or interstate road systems. So I think we have to recognise the fact that when you have much flatter social systems, which we've been moving towards steadily, I think, around the world, at least since the Second World War, is that we are perhaps losing some of that capacity to plan for the long term as we organise either around the market, which tends to be deadline-driven and productivity-driven, or we organise around the idea of social equality, which also has its limitations in terms of long-term planning. So the question is, obviously, I'm not going to, as somebody who's committed to democracy, make the argument we need to have more authoritarian structures, but I think we need to get much more creative in thinking about how we can build some hierarchical structures that can plan for the long term into our democratic systems. And I think there are ways that one can do this. One could imagine, for example, having much longer terms for an upper house in a legislature than you have in a lower house, so that basically the turnover there is much slower. You can think of ways of establishing procedures and processes which then require longer-term focus.
I'm not sure a reform of the House of Lords is going to be something that's done on climate change timescales, is it?
Steve, do you see any role for the traditional big energy companies in giving us this technological change, or do you think they're going to be sort of wiped off the board by upstart companies coming along with new technologies?
No, because I think what will happen is a little bit like IBM, you know, where the former chief of IBM says the world will need about four computers or something like that. And when smaller computing came along, desktop machines and so on, they bought up the small companies. And I think there will be innovation from small companies, and the large energy industry will buy up the intellectual property and so on. And I think actually that there is tremendous potential for the energy companies at some point for a sudden switch in their direction. And I've actually had conversations with a number of people in leading energy companies where they could at least see the argument that if they saw themselves as providers of energy services rather than providers of petroleum or gas, then that can bring about a fundamental change in the way in which they go about their business.
But all the time they're answerable to shareholders like we have with the big six in the UK. Is it not just a case that they go, all that matters for them is the cheapest energy rate, which at the moment means coal, gas? I mean, is that not just the case
That's
for the foreseeable?
That's certainly a very powerful short-term factor, but then I think there are also investors who are interested in the longer term, particularly institutional investors, and I think the companies have to take into account the interests of both.
You're in favour of some easy wins. Are there any in this area?
That's a hard one to answer. I think at the time we wrote the Hartwell paper, for example, which was some years ago now, we were quite keen on the idea of dealing with the so-called short-lived climate-forcing agents, such as black carbon, which we felt it would be possible to take action on much more quickly and without bumping into the same kind of entrenched interests and institutional obduracy that you do with carbon dioxide. I think subsequently we understand that, yes, you can do that, and that's probably going to send a very positive policy signal. But unless you pursue the long-term carbon dioxide removal, all you're doing is postponing the problem.
It's
you're not resolving it.
Just putting temperature rises back a decade or so, isn't
so,
it?
Those, but I, you know. I still think it's a good idea to do it because I think, as I say, it sends a signal that, yes, we've got a handle on this gas or we've got a handle on black carbon, and that will encourage people to think that we can do much better with the longer-term climate forces.
I wanted to finish by just asking you about the IPCC. You've got this extraordinary international group of thousands of scientists coming together for this single overarching problem. It should be this incredibly dynamic and effective body, but why isn't it that?
I worked on three of the IPCC assessments. I was a lead author on the third and fourth assessment. I have subsequently withdrawn from the IPCC. I have tremendous respect for the scientists who are engaged in it and the work that they do. But I think it's now part of the problem. In fact, after the fourth assessment report, Mike Hulme and I drafted a letter to science in which we suggested that after 20 years, if we hadn't become capable of restructuring the problem of climate change, and we were still stuck essentially with these three working groups, the science, the geography and the economics, basically, the science, the impacts and adaptation and the mitigation, then really perhaps we should be thinking very seriously about going further with what are really incremental changes in the level of knowledge there. Unfortunately, science declined to publish the letter.
Why do you think that was? Did they give you a reason?
No, but I think it is just simply part of the fact that now there is scientific capital, political capital invested in the existing structure, and so they've become somewhat self-perpetuating organisational entities. And I think there's another problem, which in fact I identified in a little editorial I did for The Guardian back at the time of the Joburg summit, where I actually called for a science strike. The argument I used was that, look, we can go on refining our knowledge of climate change and making it better and better in incremental ways. But really, that's not the point. That only, in fact, invites further disputation about the science and going down this rather unproductive science wars route, which is why, in fact, I refuse to argue about the science. I think we can just say, you know, that the large picture of the basic underlying physics is sufficient to compel us towards taking appropriate action. I think that, unfortunately, the continued focus on marginal improvements in the science is actually, if anything, a break on policy action, because there's always the temptation for policymakers to say, well, let's wait till we get the next IPCC report and then we'll know in much more detail exactly what we should do, rather than taking, I think, the step in the directions that I think need to be taken.
I'm interested in how that call for strike went down, because presumably a lot of your colleagues in science would be thinking the complete opposite.
Well, I don't think I could boast that it made a huge impact on the scientific community, but there were discussions with various colleagues, some of whom, of course, in the scientific world just felt that that was inappropriate because they are driven by values which prioritise the production of knowledge, the improvement of knowledge. I wasn't saying there was in any sense a conspiracy between scientists and policymakers, but there was, in a sense, an inadvertent kind of complementarity between the idea of scientists who genuinely want to improve the level of scientific knowledge and therefore hold out to policymakers the possibility of being able to base decision-making on better knowledge, and the interests of policymakers in not doing something that might actually be seen as being precipitate.
So how did you finish your lecture? Did you end on an optimistic note, or is that just putting a gloss on this that we don't believe in?
Well, I think a lot of the lectures actually about the controversy around climate change and the reasons why people take very different views of the matter. I explore why it is that we got involved in an extended 20-year-long surrogate argument about science that was really an argument about the market and about political priorities and how that came about. I think we can take seriously the idea of Walter Lippmann, that democracy isn't about getting people who think differently to think the same way. It's about getting people who think differently to do the same thing. And so what I try to explore in the lecture is some pragmatic solutions along the lines of energy modernisation, which I think people can buy into for different reasons. And so we can actually have a democratically respectable convergence on a course of action without necessarily having to all agree on exactly why we're doing that. We can do it for different motivations.
And you can hear all of Professor Steve Rayner's Sense About Science lecture as a separate Science Weekly podcast this week. Let's look at some of the other stories in the news this week. Adam, there was a big deal between the US and China on, of all things, climate change.
So yeah, this came out of the blue somewhat. We knew something was in the offing from Obama being over in China. But this was quite a big deal for us, and it's a significant moment. I mean, in many ways, it's a lot of people saying that this is not really actually a surprise because China's on this sort of trajectory anyway for peaking its carbon emissions by 2030. But what is new here is it's coming from the top. You know, it's coming from Jinping, and it's in a country like China carries a lot. And the US target is interesting as well. You know, they have. I think it's clear that Obama is positioning to sort of leave climate change as one of his legacy issues. You know, he said that the US will now cut emissions by a quarter by 2025, which if you look at the graph is a sort of significant sort of sharpening from where they were hoping to get for 2020. So, you know, I think it's a big deal. Politically, it's a big deal. And as a lot of people have said, from Ban Ki-moon to the UN climate chief, Christiana Figueres, and various other world leaders, this adds a lot of momentum to the UN climate negotiations, which are obviously coming to a crunch ahead of a meeting in Paris at the end of next year.
After all you've said, Steve, what does an agreement like this mean to you?
Well, I welcome it. I think it is a step in the right direction, as we argued in the Hartwell paper, that the mitigation issue was really an issue for about a dozen political entities, if you count the EU as a single one. We know that the more people you try to involve in a negotiation, the lower the common denominator gets. So I think that's partly why this bilateral has been able to set some fairly ambitious aspirations. This could well be the beginning of building something from the bottom up along the lines that we advocated in the Hartwell paper. The EU could join in. That would be a three-way agreement if we can then bring in some of the BRICS, other BRICS, and gradually build out in that way. I think that's probably a confidence-building approach that will be likely to get us further faster than a comprehensively negotiated treaty amongst all 190-odd countries where everybody has to agree everything before anything gets done.
The one thing I should sort of say is that, let's be clear, this, from a science point of view, it's not going to mean we hit 2 degrees of warming, which is what, you know, governments have agreed to keep limit temperatures to, and which is often referred to as the sort of threshold for, you know, dangerous climate change. It hasn't changed that, but politically, it's very important.
I think we need to be much more realistic about the 2-degree target. I just cannot see how we can hit that 2-degree target without actually going down the road of carbon dioxide removal technology or the implementation of some kind of sulfate aerosol injection. I think that both of those options are deeply problematic, and therefore I think we probably... I think it's really pie in the sky to talk about the 2 degrees. I understand why politicians are reluctant to let go of it, but I think that's a mistake too, because I think people will then see, when it becomes palpably obvious to everybody that it can't be met, they will then see this as yet another example of where politicians have basically been misleading the public.
Keeping with politicians, let's turn to the European Commission. They chose the evening before the Rosetta landing on a comet to quietly confirm that its most senior scientific role, that of chief scientific advisor to the president, was being scrapped. Now, this is Anne Glover, scientific advisor in Scottish government, her job being axed, along with some others, I believe. Now, there's been huge uproar from the scientific community in Britain over this, and the European Commission were lobbied against her by the Green groups, weren't they, about her stance as being essentially pro-GM. Is this anything to do with that, do you think, Adam?
Well, I think, you know, there were these letters going around, and Greenpeace, amongst others, wrote to the Commission early in the summer, and that did get a fair bit of attention. But I think it's too early to say, really, whether this is because of her outspoken views on GM. And the reality is that with GM in Europe at the moment, which has got, you know, effectively a de facto moratorium on growing GM crops, we're really just in status quo. I mean, there was a vote just this week by MEPs which will allow countries to have national bans on GM. You know, there are other things going on in the Commission in terms of slimming down and apparently with under the new Juncker administration, there's a sort of culture of moving away from regulations and targets. So it could just be that it's part of that. I think it's unlikely that they've just bowed to pressure from Green campaign groups.
And we can't wrap up this podcast without mentioning Philae, the lander, the European Space Agency's lander, which touched down on Comet 67P three times, which they've just found out, with the first bounce being about a kilometre high. This was one of those stories that seems to sort of capture the imagination of people everywhere, with all of the sort of grim stuff going on in the world. Here are a bunch of sort of dedicated engineers and scientists and technicians putting a very small lander down on a comet. And they seem to have had some good luck and bad luck. They hit the comet, they landed, they're getting science data back, but it bounced because its anchors didn't fire. It had harpoons, which were supposed to fire and secure it into the ground. As soon as it touched, they didn't fire. So it kept bouncing and seems to have ended up against a wall or in a hole from which things are looking fairly bleak. It's in the shadows. They can't get power, very much power at all, to their solar panels to charge the batteries. And by the time this podcast comes out, it may well all be over. We know they've got a matter of hours left. They may try a last-ditch attempt to bump it out into the sunlight. But at the moment, they're just trying to go with any bit of scientific testing they can do, to do a bit of drilling, to do a bit of hammering, to try and get some element of that comet into a sensor so they can actually say they've measured something directly from the surface. But Adam, do you think that story was one of the more heartening ones of the week?
I think, look, it really doesn't matter now at this point how much science is done at all. I mean, it's just a truly marvellous moment. I mean, anyone, even people who are not interested in science at all, you know, have been talking to me about it this week, and it's a really heartwarming, inspiring moment showing what humanity can do. We put a lander on a comet flying through space. I mean, it's incredible.
And it's only the size of Mont Blanc, which is pretty big. But to be fair, when you've got a whole of space to look at and it's half a billion kilometres away, a good feat. That is all we have for you this week. A big thanks to Steve Rayner and Adam Vaughan. And from me, Ian Sample, and all the science team, thanks for listening.